So I get to talk to you about EVEX, which is, as most of you know, a balloon-borne experiment that flew this past year in Antarctica. So this was our launch. EVEX is a large collaboration, as many of you know, as a number of your names are probably on this slide, Carlo, Shaul, and others. EVEX was a is a CMB polarimeter. We had well over 1,000 TS bolometers in three frequency bands for our flight. We had a resolution of 8 arc minute at all frequencies, and we achieved our polarimetry with a continuously rotating half-wave plate, which we kept at 4K and behind our cryogen shield. So this was an extremely challenging but ultimately successful application of the half-wave plate. And this was rotating on a superconducting magnetic bearing, which was also fairly novel and also worked extremely well in low. So the results from the flight, we had 11 days worth of data collected at float, and are currently being analyzed. And I'll go into some of the details. Just a caveat at the beginning. Yesterday, we had some really excellent talks from a number of experimental collaborations. EVEX, we just got our data back from the pole at the end of February. So we've really just started to scratch the surface on our data analysis. So I'll be able to talk about some of what we are seeing from in-flight, as well as from the integration campaign, so our ground calibration. But we hope to have more detailed results in the near future. So a quick overview of our instrument. This shows the schematic of the full instrument that you saw in the previous picture, the solar panels and our massive sun shields here in the back, providing radiation shielding. And then this green structure at the bottom was a radiative cooling, a liquid cooling system that we use to dissipate excess heat at float. Obviously, we don't have the ability to convectively cool, and so all of our excess power from our 31 DF digital frequency multiplexing boards needs to be radiated away to the sky. So breaking this down quickly, our experiment breaks down into two broad physical regions. In red here, you can see the outer structure here, which has the pivot motor at the top, which we use for azimuthal control, our primary azimuthal control. And we're suspended on these purple suspension cables down to an outer frame. A lot of this design was inherited from previous experiments and updated and improved upon for the EVEX experiment. In gray is the outer section of our inner frame. Now, this pivots in elevation right at this pivot point here in the outer frame. So our scan strategy was azimuthal scans with elevation steps, revisiting parts of the sky. And now, because EVEX was flying not at the pole, we're at a slightly higher latitude, the ability to use the sky motion for cross-linking was intrinsically part of the scan strategy. Stripping away some of this, you can see some of the more detailed aspects here. We were a Gregorian Dragone telescope with a 1.5 meter primary mirror. The light from the sky comes in. We have our secondary mirror sitting right above the cryostat window, and then around on the outside there are a few other aspects. Our attitude control systems, primary systems, were two star cameras and two three-axis gyroscopes, and we had a number of secondary attitude control systems which we also used during flight. You can see here magnetometers, tiltometers, a GPS antenna, and sun sensors. And then we see two of the four readout crates mounted here. These were our external mounting for the digital frequency multiplexing boards. These were connected to the radiation panels that you saw here, by some flexible tubing, and so we cooled through the backplanes of the DF MUX boards into those radiators. So following this path deeper, inside the receiver, light enters the receiver and then passes through our half wave plate here, which is mounted at 4K stage, split by a 45 degree wire grid, and then enters into the actual optics of two focal planes. We have the one mounted vertically, one mounted horizontally, and these are mirror images of each other. And so we have complementary readouts of the orthogonal polarizations at all times, and this is modulated through the half wave plate so that we can push our signal into the modulation. So a little bit deeper, our detectors, which were produced by Berkeley, were mounted on this. This represents one of our two focal planes, and as I mentioned, they're both mirror copies of each other. So we had 782 elements on one focal plane, and then inside of this 140 element decagon here. The zooming down further into the actual spider web absorber, and then the transition edge sensor bolometer in the full zoom in here. Now in this picture you can see how we've plan on assembling this focal plane. This actually gets rotated around. So in this section here, you can see our circuit boards are mounted underneath. We have two band defining filters directly in front of each of the focal planes, and these are coupled into feed horns for our detectors. So we've flown twice. We've flown EBEX twice now. The first time was in North America in 2009. This was an engineering flight. We were pushing a number of technological challenges and advancements for ballooning in general, as well as for the technology. For the CMB community as well. In North America, we flew one focal plane, and the focal plane had three wafers, 213 TS bolometers, and we used 8 times multiplexing in our DF MUX boards, the digital multiplexers. Moving to Antarctica, this is three wafers to 14 wafers and two focal planes. Supporting this, we needed to push the multiplexing factor up by two. And so, in Antarctica, we successfully demonstrated the 16 times multiplexing on the DF MUX and there's confidence that we'll be able to this will be able to be pushed higher in the near future. One of the primary challenges that we face and we're able to address in EBEX was how do we optimize this bolometer array given a number of our challenges. So as I mentioned, we're a three frequency band experiment. At our upper frequency, at the 410 frequency, what we wanted to be able to do is we want to be able to subtract our dust contribution, characterize dust contribution, be able to do that in a self-contained fashion within the same experiment. The 410 gigahertz module, though, is extremely difficult. It's very very thin, and the Berkeley lab developed this kind of a novel printing mechanism for these wafers at 500 or 55 microns at 410 gigahertz. They're able to successfully do this, and we have here this distribution here is showing the next part of this, which is the saturation power. So how we optimize this for saturation or for our PSAT levels is going to be critical at float and very different from some of the ground experiments. So our predictive loading at float levels for 250 was about 4 picowatts, and so the development needed to happen to successfully push the PSAT levels down from the much higher saturation on the ground down to to extremely low levels without hitting our saturation level without hitting our loading level. And as you can see, where our target was, our target here for 250 was at 9, and we have within a reasonably well-defined band here the majority of these detectors at loading levels which accommodate an acceptable noise range in our detection. So with this, one of the next development that that EBEX has pushed forward for a number of things is this idea of array management. It's something that is moderately, I don't want to say simple for ground, but for ground experiments you have a number of pathways that you can choose to attack this, and for balloon based experiments this is the challenge of array management. We have a limited bandwidth. Every now and again we lose our communication entirely for extended periods of time, and when it is working, it's somewhere around 20 kilobits, and so 20 kilobits per second. So doing rough math in your head, you can figure out that that's not a substantial fraction of the 1,000 bolometers data that you'll be able to see at 20 kilobits per second. And indeed, one of the things one of the luxuries that you don't have on flight is that you have this really high instantaneous sensitivity, but it also comes at a very short observation time, and so every optimizing the amount of time that you spend looking at the sky instead of fiddling with the array and trying to tune and retune, this becomes a critical issue for us. And so one of the aspects that we focused on was actually being able to do this in an automated fashion. And so we offload all of this tuning, onto our DFMUX boards themselves, onto the processors, on the digital frequency multiplexing boards, and we use our flight computer to interact with that, and we get those responses back, and the flight computer does its processing magic on them and compresses them down and sends them down to the ground station, where on the ground station these get. I see that the resolution on this has gotten very small. So, but what you should see on this is that in this we have individual cuts on the entire array and quick flagging mechanisms for ground operators. We can turn this around very quickly, and this all of the tuning happens on board. All of the tuning algorithms, all of the work to actually optimize this in the first pass happens on board. And this here is one example of from our flight, multiple tunings happening here. And individually, you can see the transition levels chosen over seven different tunings, all sitting roughly right at the same location. So we're seeing extremely good results in being able to democratize this tuning process, as it were, and the ability to scale for this type of solution is extremely robust. We're able to move much of that work away from the centralized system. So the next step, what I mentioned briefly, we moved our multiplexing to a 16 times multiplexing, and so this right here, this is a network analysis conducted on the ground, not actually a ground network analysis. But what you can pick out here, we have 16 individual peaks in our readout, and this corresponds to a single squid board, and we have here our measured in-flight noise against predicted. We're sitting roughly where we want to be. So on the x-axis here, it's measured over predicted, and so right here we're looking at exactly what we wanted, what we were predicting before flight, and this level of consistency was extremely encouraging.
How much does that contribute to your noise?
The squid noise is subdominant.
What was the noise measuring flight?
We have individual noise. Given the general here, say that again. This is true. This is that's true. So this is 10 picoamps. This exactly. It's squid. And so what you so if you're looking at rough, you know, Scholl says this is roughly 20% of the total noise contribution. So we can talk about five or so. I apologize if this resolution seems to be unreadable here, but we're talking about 10 to the 4, I believe that should be. That 10 to the 1? No, this is not the.
You're asking about calibrated noise.
Yeah, it's a full. Yeah.
Yeah, right now in microcalibration.
Don't know.
Well, so yeah. So what we're looking for per detector, we're looking for 250 or 280, 284, I believe.
That's 150.
At 250. I don't have the 150 off the top of my head. Cheryl might know that right off the top of his head.
He's asking you about actual flight performance.
Yeah. No, we don't. Yeah,
so your predicted is 250 to 280 at 250.
250 to 280. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At 150, what do you think?
Joel, or do you have that one off the? That's. Mm-hmm.
Q. Q.
So T would be twice that.
It's root 2. Yeah. Right. Data from, we don't have the analysis completed from flight, but the ground performance was less than 15% contribution on average. Now we had worse. Sub. Mm-hmm. Right. So the contribution from one to the next, this differs obviously based on the individual channel spacing for each cone.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, it is. But I don't know what the distribution range on that was for the calibration data, which was improved upon as we developed further. But Joel, are you remembering these numbers from Palestine?
So there are two sources for crosstalk. One that you asked about, one that you asked about conjunction. As far as the MUX is concerned, it's something that's completely negligible. The real source for crosstalk is optical signals that are propagating between the cavities. You go through one, and they're propagating optically to other detectors. And those are sort of on the percent level. And we're sort of now looking at the calibration data from Palestine to quantify that over the entire array. But the optical crosstalk, not from the MUX, from the wafer array themselves, dominate over anything that we have on the MUX.
But
the
percent level is not.
It, you have to know. The question is, how well do you know that in your VMAX and so on and so forth? So it's not how much it is, it's how much you know about it and how you work.
Is it higher frequency channel?
You see that?
I'm just wondering where it's coming from.
The back shorts. Mm-hmm. And so you have the cavities, the wafers, and the back shorts.
Okay. No, I didn't know what kind of prior. So you're not talking about wire grid scattering power?
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah. So you have the waveguides. The light comes from the waveguides into the bolometer, and then you have the silicon. So it's just across the silicon.
That's the same thing.
Great.
So, the overview of our flight. We had 11 days of observation, and 12 days of hold time in our cryogens, roughly what we had predicted. And then 25 days total at float before we cut down. Over this time, we accumulated about 1.3 terabytes of science data. And our observation, there was an error in one of the thermal models, and that was used by the NASA engineer, and this caused an overheating in one of the motor control boxes. This limited the amount of azimuthal control we had. So we have two modes of azimuthal control: the pivot motor, and then we have a large reaction wheel, which we use for our fine pointing control. And we can use this to a limited degree to control some azimuthal motion, but without a primary azimuthal control, our initial our scan strategy ended up being a much broader than initially anticipated. So this ended up looking at a very large patch of sky over the over a range of deck.
Your upper rotator.
Yes. No. The rotator actually was fine. We recovered it. I should say we tested it at recovery and it freely rotated. The rotator itself worked as long as the control box was not overheated. Unfortunately, the control box itself had the temperature issue.
What you're missing is that the motor control box for the upper motor overheated because of the error of the NASA engineer. Not the flight.
Who designed the control box?
Well, the control box is off the shelf. Is off the shelf. So how this works is we give our model to an engineer at NASA who runs his thermal modeling on it, and then he comes back to us and says, well, based on my calculations, and the temperature limits that you specify, we need to make this change and that change and this change. One of those changes was decoupling the motor control box from a heat sink, and so this was unintentional on his part, but it overheated. And when it overheats, it trips a thermal circuit and just shuts down. So that just shuts off control until it cools back down.
Did you see the sun during the rotations?
So we had control over elevation, and so we're actually, so the sun sits at a low elevation in, at the December, January. So we're actually able to control elevation to avoid the sun, and so we did not directly observe the sun at all. No. Yes. Yep. I'll show a couple of details on how that shook down. Exactly, and it was the half wave plate was extremely stable modulation. So there are a number of aspects of how the flight occurred that lead us to be cautiously optimistic about what we'll be able to extract. What this ends up looking like when we have this free rotation, if we're just spinning around an azimuth, this doesn't work very well at all, especially for our pointing control. We can't reconstruct exactly where we're looking at any given point in time. But this wasn't actually the case. What we saw instead was we saw this large DC shift, and these are hours here on the axis. We saw this large DC shift where we rotate about in the sky, and superimposed upon this large DC shift, we actually have an oscillatory pattern. And the oscillatory pattern, here we're talking about a 50 degree peak to peak. Over on this side, we're talking 20 degree peak to peak. And so what we actually executed with our data was we see here at the turnaround, we're slow down enough that we can acquire a star camera image, and then we scan back 50 degrees, we slow down, we stop, we acquire another star camera image, and we're able to integrate back and forth across this period of sky. And so if you collapse this down, and you collapse this down in RA, or you collapse this down in DEC, you see that there aren't, what we have is we have our hits accumulate to a substantial degree across the same patch of skies, roughly same times, and then we do have the opportunity for executing the original cross-linking that we were hoping to do pre-flight.
You're getting a star camera image like at every point of turnaround there.
Yes. Yes. So star camera image, and so this integration time is maybe 50 seconds, 2 minutes. Say this again.
Sensor.
Oh, this. During flight, we have an amalgam. We calculate our azimuth and our elevation on the fly during flight. So we have a rough filter which weights and aggregates all of our coarse pointing sensors, and so these data are a combination of star camera, gyroscope, magnetometer, sun sensor. This is our in-flight pointing solution.
What was your planned scan speed?
Our planned scan speed was peak to peak at 17. We were about 0.7. So this is faster than we wanted, slower, but we were planning on roughly transiting 0.7 degrees per second at the midpoint.
The telescope is drifting, or is there any attempt at getting magnet control?
So what we did periodically. Periodically, as the gross motion moved toward and the sky provided the ability for us to look at a calibrator, RCW-38, for instance, we would use some of the limited pointing control we had to slow ourselves down, scan over calibrators as we had the ability to in the larger picture, but of course, if you're controlling with a flywheel, you rapidly use up all of the acceleration available to you, hit your maximum speed, and then you can't do anything except move back in the other direction. So
the elevation during this time, what was the elevation doing? Were you actively controlling?
Yes, absolutely, actively controlling the elevation throughout the flight.
Is asking about, let me just straight away. So the elevation nominally is at 54 degrees fixed. We can do it, but it's fixed at 54 degrees. And so if you don't think about the calibrator stands, then you're executing a sine wave in DEC, essentially, for one given location, the sine wave in DEC. And so, and as the day goes along, the sine wave sort of moves across the sky. So that gives you the strip in DEC. When we go close to a calibrator scan, RCW-38, then we move the elevation and we go down to scan across the calibrator, and then we go back up to 54. So nominally, we're at constant 54 degrees, except, and we let the gondola rotate around, except when we're on a calibrator scan, where we go down to whatever the elevation of the calibrator is.
Okay.
So
you didn't change that, right?
54 degrees, that's it.
What's the RHI hit map look like? That's what we want to see.
Right. So the reason I'm not showing that. I know. You've seen an inaccurate copy already. And the reason I'm not showing that is because it is inaccurate. So there was an attempt made to estimate which bolometers were active and tuned, and it was a gross attempt, but it was just wrong. In that it did not accurately convey what our heat map is, and so right now that's one of the things that's being calculated as soon as we suss out the full pointing stream. Probably it's probably actually happening right now. We have the ability to then generate that heat map. So the answer is shortly. But the inaccurate copy we don't have. Yeah.
So you have a 410 channel.
Right.
And what's the? I couldn't integrate that into where it's actually passing through the plane, or through the galaxy. How much? Really interesting dusty emission might not be able to get.
Mm-hmm. Right. 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 Yeah. You'll. So that. So let me see. Let me go back. So your galaxy here. I'm sorry. I don't have coordinates on here. RA deck. We're going to pass through large sections of the galactic plane.
It's about a third of that. Mm-hmm. A third of this entire area is across the galaxy.
Yeah.
And it goes to intense dust region, to the low dust region. So yeah. Cross correlating with 353 would be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can use auxiliary data.
Absolutely.
Actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So about,
okay, that's the plan. We've got it all under control.
About a third of that 6,000 square degrees, about 2,000 square degrees, is gas.
Will that lock in at some level? Allow you to at least do a fuzzier solution to
are you talking about the polarimetry of the half wave plate, or are you talking about the attitude solution?
But I'm just saying that because you'll be able to lock into plane pointing, you may be able to aid.
Okay. Yeah. No. You're asking largely about the. Yeah, right. So this this is
great pointing.
This is the thing. The attitude solution solutions were functioned excellently. This was so
pointing, they just couldn't control it very well.
Exactly the right sentence. We can reconstruct for the high accuracy. I don't know if Seth has
that. That was the star camera bit.
So we're talking about we have star camera we're separated by about a minute. Absolutely. And so we're looking at we're looking at arc minute pointing in our first pass, and it's only improving from there.
How did it cryo do when you reversed in azimuth? Did it change temperatures on the focal plane?
Good question. No, it didn't. So this right here. So this is just a plot of the, so this is the vertical focal plane. So we're talking about 260 millikelvin, stable temperature. And so breaking this out into a power spectrum, you can see we're stable here to the millihertz level. So we're stable over roughly an entire scan.
From ground-based data, even when we moved around at much faster speed, much higher acceleration than we actually moved across the system.
So the sun didn't actually shine on the. The sun didn't actually shine on the crust. So we have ground screen in front. We have our baffling in back. We're looking up at 52, 56 degrees, and we're well shielded from that effect. And we did not observe any scan. Synchronous temperature effects at all. This is stable. Our ability to extract data from the flight is really unimpeded by many of the experimental systematics that account for the details in much of the experiment. So the halfway plate was also extremely stable for the entire flight and accumulated well over a million rotations. During the flight without issue and averaged about 15 milliwatts for power dissipation. And so our stability here is at the 0.2% level on the half-wave plate. So our reconstructing the angular position of the half-wave plate for the detectors is underway. Additional aspects of this. So, asked about galaxy observations. We observed multiple galaxy crossings. Many times, this is one example of a galaxy crossing that we pulled out during flight, and multiple calibrations on RCW-38 when it was available. We were able to perform sky dips to measure the effect of optical loading against depth, and were successful in the aspects of the experiment which were technologically challenging were extremely successful, including the full array tuning for kilopixel array, the halfway plate operation, as well as all of the basic housekeeping that is required to actually get these data back, the pointing sensors, telemetry, data storage. These functioned extremely well. So some of the pre-flight calibration measurements, we measured our beam and saw that we were at about 7 arc minutes. So we feel confident in how the near field measure. Say that again. I'm not saying that says that our beam is 7 arc minutes. Absolutely not. What I'm saying is that our calculation, our near field measurement of the beam was 7 arc minutes. This is without the skewedness of non-Gaussian aspects of the beam distribution. We did not observe this in our near field. So we feel confident that we'll be able to accurately measure on the. That's correct. Yeah, our telescope is it was fairly. So then a couple quick comments on where we're looking to move with EBEX in the near future. So with all of the technological development in actually bringing the difficult aspects of this ballooning to kind of a successful conclusion, what we want to be able to do now is take this and apply it in a larger context. Take the scaling one step further, and we've had a number of talks already where experiments are moving towards these multichoroic detectors, sinuous antennas that Adrian and company are developing. And so this follows a very similar design, stacked readout stacked circuit boards behind a lens lit array of dual polarization multichoroic detectors, and this would be running a total of 6,048 detectors and at 64 times multiplexing. So moving from what we are right now at 16x to 64x in the readout system. Yes, it does. Yes, with retrofit. So in the existing cryostat, you recall we had the two focal planes. We'd be moving to a single focal plane, maintaining the rotating half wave plate for polarimetry, and then with the single focal plane, we're able to adjust the geometry, but it would be retrofitting the same cryostat. And so anticipated performance of this of this layout, which is currently in the detector, the development detector development for this is currently in proposal. So we're hoping to see hoping to kind of push that forward in the very near future, looking at our upper limits on our 0.007, excluding some of the systematics and cleaning.
These bands are all accessible from the ground. So are these three frequency bands?
These for EBEX 6K. Yes. Yes. What's the main size? What we can achieve with this is the two basic we're talking about yesterday. Two basic reasons why you want to do balloons is you either have accessible bands or you have higher instantaneous sensitivity. And so, with the higher instantaneous sensitivity, the proven aspects of what we have developed already with the system, the turnaround time for this is much quicker. If we're and with that, we're looking at the ability to fly more quickly, roughly same budget, and to achieve similar results. So it's a trade-off, but the ballooning trade-off is a good one in this aspect, we believe.
I mean, we think so second to right, there's another element. We know that high probability that if you get 90 to 220, cycles on this time scale, you can get higher frequency in Chinese right. You fly higher frequency, whether the American gain can actually produce or develop higher frequency, that's an outstanding question. So this is essentially using what we know we can get.
So quickly, a sign on to produce these detectors for Simon's array.
You're trying to figure out the manpower issue.
Yeah, because I'm seeing a lot of these detectors.
Yes.
And so
there are more.
And so you know as well as I do that for the last 10 years, 15 years, all of these experiments were delayed and were throttled essentially with the technical development. So the calibration is extreme.
This is one of the reasons why we've chosen to push forward proposing detector development first, and then moving on to the for us what is now the easier aspect of actually ballooning, bringing an experiment from the ground to flight success and successfully collecting those data. So the first step for us is detector development. This happens, as you say, potentially manpower limited by manpower, time, fabrication resources, whatever our bottleneck ends up being there. I think it's unlikely that everyone Berkeley has proposed to develop these detectors for gets funded, but as far as the ability to develop these, I think that there are a number of we'll say synergies that go into that development process that we get to benefit from polar bears' experience before this development happens.
I think the other answer there is some of this is technology development for future NASA interests.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
One of the things that NASA looks at here. Whether yes, you can do a lot of this on the ground. It's obviously being done on the ground.
But it doesn't prove anything for a future satellite mission. Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. G-values need to go way down. And it turns out that getting those small G-values in a repeatable fashion is much harder than the community would have guessed 5 or 6 years ago. It's not when you get the long, really long skinny legs, it turns into a quasi one-dimensional problem. The bulk properties of silicon then are not the controlling factor. What's the controlling factor is the surface roughness of your side edges from your whether using a reactive ion edge or a deep reactive ion edge. They give you completely different conductivities in a way that's very process dependent. So there you need to have the same team working on this thing for a couple of years in order to work out the process, control it, so that you can produce something where every time you crank out a wafer full of detectors, you hit the G value once, and not some random G value that's set by some uncontrolled aspect of your etching process.
From roughening on
the edges, yeah. And that turns out to be the dominant, one of the dominant things.
Yeah.
The other point that I think maybe Chalene has referred to is that it's not only the fab. Once you get to this scale, you're already in thousands. Just testing and characterizing the array, which is what we do, not Berkeley. This is an immense amount of work. Immense. And so it's true, it is a bottleneck.
But so you're saying that it's more difficult to develop this for balloon for low loading
and space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, space and balloon.
Or at the least it's different. At the very minimum, it's a different.
It's a different.
Thing. Right. I was saying it's harder.
There is a simple reason.
It's harder, but if you have big fat legs that are pulling out a gigawatt of heat, those are the G's are simple to calculate, and when you make them, you hit the G's every time. It's not very process dependent. When you go to very very low thermal conductances, that drives the geometry to long skinny legs, and then you start to get into process dependent things. Unless you start doing now, Carlin Rossum at Goddard has developed a really nifty leg geometry now that has big fat legs with basically holes built into it, and it acts as a photonic choke. So you're scattering photons off in a resonant way, phonons off in a resonant way, and that allows you to dial up the thermal conductance you want using basically the quantum properties of the phonons. So you're not assuming you're in some ballistic limit. You know. That's an interesting new development that may make some of these ultra low thermal conductances easier to achieve in a large array format.
Right, this sort of transitioning that from process art to process science, that becomes easier to generalize in a large sense.
Well, in the FPIE
So last night I showed this presentation to Shaul, and he said, "What? There's no half-wave plate, but we need to talk about half-wave plate because this is interesting." So Joel's going to talk a little in more detail about what we actually did with our half-wave plate during the flight.
So. Sort of to ask an open-ended question that I don't think we need to ask now, but while we're on the subject of detectors, now people have had a chance to look at Planck and look at the papers, you know, you see what the cosmic ray environment was like for Planck. And so what are the detector builders thinking, doing about cosmic rays?
For satellite.
Yeah,
because only balloon, we don't see that access.
Yeah.
No, I know.
Your question is valid for
ST. But so it's an open-ended question that I'm just. I think a compelling satellite proposal will have to address cosmic rays.
Too bad they're tiny.
We had an elevated unexpected rate as they see
them. I mean cosmic rays.
When I was a graduate student, I calculated the cosmic ray hits on balloons that they're using for gamma rays, so they do exist.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
They're
at the level that we're able to mitigate. So we had in place a system. To measure these sorts of single event upsets, and with this, we saw when we were down there, when that happened, latched a small subset, and then. With that information, we can monitor, make intelligent decisions about when that gets retuned.
So is it basically because the low energies that just aren't getting through?
No, remember the whole point of the spiral bolometer.
Yeah,
part of the plan was to reduce the flux in the absorber for a long duration flight, right? Beginning the boomer.
Yeah.
And so effectively. That's what we're using the same thing. We're not seeing a significant flux in our detector because of the spiral wave.
Right, but my point is that the satellite test and development was the balloon test and development of the bolometers for a long time was good, but now we know a lot more about the actual cosmic ray environment. And it's more of a cosmic ray continuum.
It's it was, to a large extent, it was solar cosmic rays that were essentially were somewhat shielded from the Earth because of our magnetic field. So I think that's actually part of the explanation.
But I think you're not, I think people aren't understanding the purpose of my question. The purpose of my question is completely tangential to the balloon program. What are the detector builders? How are they incorporating cosmic ray mitigation into their design?
We'll just put the detectors in the left box.
Yeah, right. With no opening.
Okay.
So it's an open-ended question, but it needs to be addressed.
It might not help.
So how many slides?
Oh, just a few. Don't wear many.
Yeah.
10, 15. The
problem
if I go on the ground, there's no cosmic ray.
The thermal active volume has gone way down even since the Slayer flare generation, right? So reducing is then that's all of our new designs at tiny islands. That's got it all taken by another factor.
Well, okay, I don't want to get into the discussion because I'm going to cutting out my own time. I mean, you know that most of the heating in Planck is the overall substrate around, not the bolometer itself. So, anyway.
And as you know, I mean, comparing that will be the web designs will be or the web design against the sinuous design. Should we move on to this get funded for this 6K will be.
So, with EVEX, we had three main new challenges that we wanted to address. Seth has already talked some about detectors and readout, and I just wanted to expand a little bit about polarimetry. I'm showing this old plot from Maxipol time stream. This is all calibrated now. Phil is not here. Phil likes calibrated plots, correctly so, but it's calibrated. This is just one of the time streams of the detector with the synchronous signal removed when you spin a half-wave plate. We saw with Suzanne's presentation yesterday, this also came up with Maxipol. There's a rotation synchronous signal. This is rotation synchronous signal removed, but not demodulated. What's shown here are the signal bands. Again, this is all from Maxipol. This side of the signal band is determined by scan speed. This is by the beam size. When you demodulate onto the rotation frequency, this is one of the Q and U, Q or U demodulated time streams, essentially. This is the power spectra. And so you see the stability similar to what Suzanne had shown yesterday, all the way down to about 1 millihertz with this particular guy. And with Maxipol, you know, the majority of the data had very good stability. So that stability, coupled with the optical properties of the wave plate, had sort of suggested to us that we should pursue the same thing with EBEX. With EBEX, there were two major challenges that we had to improve upon relative to what we've done with Maxipol. We had to develop this low power continuous rotation at 4 Kelvin. Why 4 Kelvin? This was also done with Maxipol, but it was a different technique. I don't want to dwell on that. Because for a balloon, you could show that if the wave plate is running at anything hotter than 50 Kelvin, then emission from the wave plate itself becomes a dominant source of load. So we needed to develop a mechanism to do that at lower temperatures, at 50 Kelvin or lower. And the other was the extended bandwidth. We want to operate at three frequency bands, remove foregrounds with the data that we have, or address foregrounds. So these were the two challenges. The first challenge of continuous rotation at 4 Kelvin, so I think many of you know, we use a superconducting magnetic bearing. This is a sketch of the system. There's a high temperature superconductor, and above that, we fix a magnet here, and inside the magnet, we put the half-wave plate. We cool this together at this separation to below 95 Kelvin, which is the transition temperature of the high-temperature superconductor. And then it just levitates, and it's stable in orientation. You can flip it around. You can think about it as a rigid, system with springs in all directions, and these are fairly rigid springs. How do we keep it in place? We keep it in place at above the superconducting temperatures with three grippers. So this is now a top view. The grippers are actuated with they are connected. They're spring-loaded, spring-loaded grippers that are connected to an actuator with Kevlar wire. So this is spring-loaded, holding it at high temperature. When we cool down below 95 Kelvin, we actuate the actuator. It pulls the grippers. The grippers go back, and then it all levitates and can rotate. The rotation is achieved by means of a belt that you see here. It's a Kevlar belt. It's rotated by a pulley here. This is a tensioner pulley, and the pulley is connected to the outside world with a shaft. And so this is a picture of the implementation. You could see the grippers, one, two, and another one on the other side. You could see the edge of the actuator right there. You can hardly see the Kevlar wires that are here wrapped around some pulleys. You can see the pulleys. This is the tensioner pulley. This is the pulley that goes out to the outside world. And we encode position by means of these slots. So when this turn, this is the rotor, you cannot see the stator. You cannot see the the HTS. And the half frame is not mounted. So this is the rotor. This is the Kevlar belt. When this rotates, this chopper moves around, and we have a 4 Kelvin LED and a diode that encode position.
So is it more efficient to drive from the outside rather than simply drive it internally?
I don't know, because we have not had the chance to completely develop an internal drive. Certainly at the state of development that we were in, by doing an inside electromagnetic drive. So when you say inside, clearly it's more efficient as opposed to putting the DC motor inside, because the DC motor would dissipate power. So if you just use some DC motor, that would not be very efficient. What you're probably referring to is building something magnetic to move this. We simply didn't, we ran out of time with the development. And I don't have anything sort of working. No, it's cooling radiatively. It's a Kevlar belt, it's cooling radiatively. Yeah. Yes, there will be heat transport, exactly. So there's friction in those stainless steel bearings, and there will be some heat transport. We find that the main, so the question is, are we worried about wave plate temperature, or worried about load on 4 Kelvin? We find that the main load on the 4 Kelvin, we think the main load of the 4 Kelvin are eddy currents, just from the rotating magnet. And we think the residual friction from the belt contributes to some heating of the wave plate. So the rotation here is so. So Seth has shown that. So this all works. It has already worked in the North American flight. This is from this flight, 60-minute section of data. And this is speed as a function of time. 1.235, the RMS is 0.2%. So we turn at 1.235, not because of any constraints from this system. We turn at this low rate, or however, whatever you want to say, we are driven by time detector time constants. This is the main driver for this speed. It is also true that speed affects heat dissipation, but we could have doubled that, and we still would have been fine with heat dissipation.
Systematically, I suppose you drop the rotation by factor 10.
Drop down?
I understand you're scanning at the same time, so it's problematic.
Right, right. The idea was we wanted to rotate fast enough to have sufficient number of QU per beam before our scan strategy moves along. So that was the driver for this frequency. Right. The other part of right. So as I said, the trade-off is it's a question of how much friction and heat dissipation you would get from the belt driven by the shaft, versus if you have some sort of a bearing inside
and then you would connect that bearing to an outside surface, right? Because you'd have to have, so, if you want to have drive inside, there are two parts for heat dissipation, the actual drive and motor, and how you hold the wave blade in place. And so if you use any other bearings that are not superconducting magnetic bearings, you have friction for those extra bearings, and those scale with size. And so I can't tell you at the moment. We think that the friction we get from the belt rotation is smaller, significantly smaller than we would have gotten if we didn't have a magnetic bearing and we just had some, big roller bearing or some smaller ones, holding them on the side. Yep. But certainly there's much lower power dissipation as compared to putting any motor inside. Okay. Any motor that we could come up and that we had by the time we had to develop that, and anything, we have looked at a number of options. And we had developed our own electromagnetic drives, but they were not sufficiently efficient in terms of heat dissipation to replace what we have here. Okay, the other element, as I described, was the broad electromagnetic frequency. Tomo had mentioned that yesterday. We had opted to use a five-stack achromatic half-wave plate, sometimes called Pancharagnam, because of this guy in the 1950s that had shown that this can work. So this is of course a simulation of the efficiency with the three EBEX frequency bands. This shows the essentially made stack. There are five plates here, 24 centimeter in diameter. With two out of the three layer air coat, the third one was done later at Cardiff in Minnesota. That's 24 centimeter diameter, as I said. This is all measured warm at Cardiff on a Fourier transform spectrometer. And so I'm not going to dwell on that too long. This is one set of their measurements. Each curve here is at a different. It's a spectrum. It's a transmission versus frequency. So essentially, it's a transmission measurement versus frequency. At each rotation of the half-wave plate, there are 29 rotation angles, and this is done for three input angles. From this data cubed, essentially, you can calculate the predicted modulation efficiency. One thing I would want to point out is that overall decrease comes from the absorption in the wave plate as a function of frequency, and that absorption is expected to be much lower at cryogenic frequencies. So if you had measured that cold, this would be much flatter at the top, although this particular comment doesn't change the modulation frequency. The modulation efficiency just goes to overall transmission. And so these are measurements from Palestine that we're in the process of analyzing, the data that we're in the process of analyzing. On the left is the 410 gigahertz measured modulation efficiency as a function of angle, and the fit gives us 92%. It's very similar to predictions. And at 150 gigahertz, we have 97%. I think Charlene mentioned that yesterday, that there is an interesting effect and potentially problematic effect with those achromatic half-wave plates. And the issue is that with a regular plate, a single half-wave plate, when you send polarized light, yay orientation, you get yay back, or at least there's sort of, you get yay back. That's not the case with an achromatic wave plate. An achromatic wave plate, one way to think about it is that the ordinary and extraordinary axis of the wave plate, the orientation of the ordinary and extraordinary are frequency dependent, which is not the case for a single wave plate. Okay, and so the effective extraordinary are frequency dependent, and the angle depends then the angle that you have in any real experiment depends on the instrument bandwidth and the spectrum of the sources. And so that gives rise to an interesting issue. And by the way, this is shown here. This is, again, comes from these measurements. This is the angle of the effective ordinary or extraordinary axis as a function of frequency. And this is borne out by the measurements that we're doing. And so the issue is, how do you reconstruct QU of the sky in the presence of CMB plus dust when the effective axes depend on the spectrum of your sources, and you don't know the spectrum of your sources sufficiently well, or there's some error in the knowledge of those spectrum.
The angle is also changing over any given pass band. It must result in a reduced efficiency, because there is no angle for range of
efficiency. No. How should I say that? This is all encoded here. This is all encoded essentially there. This is the modulation efficiency over those bands. You don't get a different answer. No, as long as you know what is the effective axis at this frequency, then
integrate over a range of frequencies.
Yeah, you integrate over a range, that's right. And when you integrate over a range, this is what you get essentially. This is what you get. You're right on what you're saying, but this is what you get. When you integrate, it depends on the range over a band, right? It depends on the rotation over a band. So, for 150 gigahertz band, depending on the bandwidth, depending on how much this rotation is. So that's it. You're referring to sort of off-axis angles, rays. This, you're right. This is all normal incidence calculations. All of the calculations I've shown are normal incidence calculations. You're right. So going back to this.
What's your divergence angle?
At the wave plate, it's about 10, 12 degrees at the wave plate. So it's we have done some calculations and we've done some measurements. It's not a significant effect at those degrees. So going back to this effect and how to deal with that, so we have asked ourselves the first question is, this is all coming from a paper by one of our grad students in Minnesota. And this is now, there's no data here except simulations. This is a paper that's all based on simulations. We're asking ourselves the question, does it even matter at the level of dust that we expect in our patch of the sky, does this even matter? And so this shows simulations. We simulate dust and CMB. We assume known bands, and we include no instrument noise. And then we correct for CMB rotation, because we know the spectrum of the CMB, so there's no problem there. And we ignore dust. First, we ignore dust completely. And then we correct for dust intensity, but don't correct for the angle. And so the magenta is when we don't correct for dust at all. And obviously you see that you get excess power. This is simply, for example, this is for R0.05 and dust contrast or dust polarization of 5%. This is simply because we have contamination in our bands, just intensity contamination in our bands. And so these are these power spectrum of the magenta. When you take the dust intensity out, which you can get from either known data or from our own bands, but you don't correct for the rotation, you see it doesn't matter for low polarization levels, 2%, or say maybe you could see something at 2%, at 5%. When you go to 10% dust polarization, you start to see this bias at low Ls, which comes from no corrections for the angle that's coming from the wave plate. And so that's does it even matter? At high polarization levels, yes, it matters. And so now you can ask the question, okay, fine, let's do the most stupid thing, non-optimal, the most stupid thing you can think about, and just say, well, let's just say that everything that you measure 150 is CMB, regardless of what it really is, because there's some contamination from dust, and everything that you measure at 410 is dust. And now you say, from your own data, from our own data, we will estimate the dust spectral index from 410 and 250, assuming that that we know that everything in 410 is dust, and we will assume that everything at 150 is CMB. So this is wrong, but that's what we assume, and therefore we can estimate the dust spectral index at 410 and 250, and then just given that data, now we know, at least in these assumptions, we know what the dust is, and we can correct the angle. And so this shows that when you do that at a level of, and then you put this into the simulation at a level of R of 0.01, and even if the dust is 10%, you could see there's no bias in the data, and these error bars already include all of the errors that go into these instrument noise and the correction that goes in. So at the levels that we need it, this is doable.
It doubled the error or something.
What's the difference between the red and the blue?
The red is the input, and the blue is the extracted. This includes instrument noise, includes everything. Yes, it does increase the error bar, and therefore, this is, as I said, this is the most stupid thing you could do, and what Chaoyun is working on now is doing sort of an optimal estimation, and we'll see what comes out of that. And I think that's all I wanted to say about polarimetry. Yes.
Simulations. I mean, 150. You do have to worry about low frequency galactic polarized emission.
Yes.
But if you want to get down to our values of 0.05, that sort of value, then that small contribution.
Yes. Yes. So.
What's your proposal for controlling low frequency polarized emission?
We conducted the program cleaning studies, which was the objective of the study, and found using parameterization, and find that the synchrotron of contamination according to the present models is negligible with respect to the disturbance due to the dust for the 0.05 target. Okay, so that's our conclusion. It's in the literature. We have to improve on that based on the incoming data. This was pre-planned work, massive pre-planned. This needs to be double checked again because there is a lot of incoming information.
I just want to clarify the question, George. Are you asking in context of this half-wave plate stuff, or just generically, generally? Oh, generally, generally, generally.
Question because, right, right, because right. In the same paper, and in the same area, shifting the foreground, the frequency set to include the 90 gigahertz channel, which is another a popular channel for polar vendors. There, you see that if you don't, according to the models, if you don't account for synchrotron in the foreground modeling, you're biased. At 150, that didn't matter, according to the models. At 90, we definitely detected it. It didn't matter.
If I could take another 30 seconds, I want to address 2 points that came out earlier. Just to clarify, Dick, this was your question about pointing. This shows first cut on point reconstruction. We have star camera solutions. This is all from flight now. Star camera solutions, and in this particular case, we're identifying 3, 6, 3, 7, 8 objects given identified star camera, which have very, very low error in flight, you know that you identify, so this is a function of time, and this is RANDEC. You identify these images in RANDEC, this one and this one, and then you use the gyros to reconstruct back and forth in-flight data. And so that solution, as I said, oops, sorry. That solution, this is first cut as of about a week and a half ago, that already gives us between 1 and 2 arc minutes from about 50 to 60% of the images. We expect about a factor of 4 to 5 better improvement on that in the next round. So this will give us 10 to 20 arc seconds, and this is plenty good enough for what we need. Which we have from the star cameras. Yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And I don't know, Phil, whether this was whether this was what you were asked about. If it isn't, then it isn't. But you were asking about, you know, this error. This is the motor controller, and this is the baffle, and the sun is in the back, and we were supposed to observe in the front. The error that that has happened with the engineer is that when he ported the model, he moved this baffle to be slanted. And this baffle, this is, we have seen that image only after, you know, after flight. There's a section of the baffle that's vertical. It was supposed to be vertical all the way down, and he moved it to be slanted like that, shielding the motor controller.
He's happy because you're worried about it getting too cold.
He was worried about it getting too cold. Exactly. Now, we didn't know that he made that error. And he admits, there's no doubt about that. So that was the issue. That was the issue. Okay, just to properly close this discussion. So to date, you know, EBEX was the first to use TES arrays. We had first demonstrated digital domain frequency muxing, which is now used ground, and we will use in the future. We have used the superconducting magnetic for astrophysical polarimetry. We have a significant amount of data. A part of which is on the galaxy, part of which is off the galaxy. We're planning, hoping to launch our next generation experiment. Okay?